Hello and welcome back to CMU Booked, CMU's official book podcast. My name is Sam.
And I'm Hannah.
And, you know, spring break is just around the corner. We have an exciting book this week.
It is The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler.
Yes, it is my second time reading it, and this is your...
First time. First time, definitely was not expecting to love it as much as I did.
Stay tuned and enjoy.
Let's just get into it.
Emma Johnson. I am a fourth year PhD student in the English Department Literary and Cultural Studies program here. My specialty is film and media studies. I majored in English and film in undergrad, and I've really leaned into the film side of things since coming here, partially because of the classes I took. I'm just more interested in that. But I'm currently teaching a Books You Should Have Read By Now course on noir fiction and noir adaptation specifically, so that I can bring some of that film stuff in there as well. But noir is like one of my few now literary interests that I'm super passionate about. So I figured for a Books You Should Have Read By Now course, let's go with the detective fiction, and it's been a lot of fun. Yeah.
And honestly, I mean, that's why I suggested this. I'm in Emma's class, and we read The Big Sleep, and now we're reading LA Confidential, and it's just like such an iconic story, novel, and movie.
Yes.
It perfect for this episode.
Yeah. No, this was a stellar pick. I'm so jealous that I'm not in this class. I'm actually dying to get into it. But luckily, I have had some Emma Johnson in my life. She was my TA for Intro to Film, which is iconic.
Shout out. I think I'm on round like 8 now. It's been 3.5 years, something like that.
So. Love it. Yeah. Incredible.
Time. And so, like, Raymond Chandler, just for reference, he has a plethora of noir novels, like The Long Goodbye, Lady in the Lake, but we chose this one because of like sort of the iconic status. And it's just like, it's different from his other ones. I love Lady in the Lake.
But I added it to my list since you recommended it. I regret to say that I haven't read that much other Chandler.
This is my first one, and honestly, I have to say I really liked it. So I appreciate the recommendation.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so hype. Noir has a lot of elements that are very central to the genre itself, and so like it's good to situate yourself within what to expect. Once you know what's gonna happen, it's a very confusing narrative.
Right.
Getting yourself a little acclimated within it lends itself to understanding it more. So, like, I thought maybe we could start off going over some of those tropes, those very pivotal things that are central to the genre and are present in this book. And so, do you want to go over some of those?
Noir is kind of a specific subsect of the broad umbrella of, like, detective fiction. And so, in our class, we started with Edgar Allan Poe's Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is often cited as like the first detective story, which is very, like, Sherlock Holmes is heavily inspired by that kind of breed of detective fiction. Mm-hmm. Noir, and specifically this is hard-boiled detective fiction would be like another term used for this subgenre, emerges in like the post-World War I period, 30s and 40s, with specifically Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. And it's a little bit different than previous iterations of the genre, because with Murders in the Rue Morgue, for example, or Sherlock Holmes, you have this kind of genius detective figure solving this puzzle, like this mystery. And that's kind of the central thrust of the story, is solving the mystery. Scholars have described this as like the primacy of plot, like the plot is central. Noir is a little different than that, because the characterization and the kind of world that we're existing in is in a lot of ways more important than the actual mystery unfolding. So you get that hard-boiled detective character, right? In our case, with The Big Sleep, Philip Marlowe. He's usually pretty cynical.
Our blonde devil.
Yes. And he's kind of navigating this dirty, dingy urban landscape, right? With a lot of like crime, seedy underbelly of the city. And a lot of that navigation also involves encountering female characters that are dangerous or threatening in various ways.
Femme fatale.
Yeah, fatal woman, right? Yeah. That's where the name comes from. So, yeah, a lot of bad guys and murder and general moral confliction. Yeah.
No one's hands are clean.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
No one's hands are clean.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like you were saying, you were talking about kind of like the general atmosphere kind of being so important to it. That was something I had to learn while reading this as somebody who hasn't read a lot of noir or even like detective. I was so caught up in like going backwards to the pages trying to figure out who's who that I had to just eventually let myself get swept into the world.
Yeah. It's a lot to keep track of. That's definitely another feature of the genre. And I think I said in class, like, I like to keep a tally on the front page. Yep, there we go. Of all the character names, just so... Because it helps me. You kind of have to map it out, right?
Yeah,
because there's
so,
so many names getting thrown at you every other page. And it, yeah, you have to go back and say, wait, who is Owen Taylor?
Let yourself get swept
away. Yeah, or that. Because ultimately, in the end, there's a lot of things we still don't know. Mm-hmm. And who did what? And that's less important, right?
Exactly.
Than just like experiencing it.
Right. That like primacy of plot comes secondary to getting this very intense characterization of primarily, you know, like you're saying, the hard-boiled detective, which Marlowe, and the femme fatale, which also we've spoken about, but is sort of a little more complicated in The Big Sleep, which was why I also thought it would be good for a podcast episode, just because it's a little, at least in my from my perspective, I don't know who I would call the femme fatale in this novel. You know, you usually have one. I mean, you know, I referenced The Lady in the Lake. Once you read it, hopefully you read it.
Absolutely.
It is, there's one lady in that lake. Right. You know what I'm saying? There's
she's the lady. Yeah.
It's not ladies in the lake, but,
or like
reading something like neo-noir where you get, you know, multiple, you know, female protagonists is a loose word, but... supporting characters who are also femme fatale adjacent, but also with other things. And so with Vivian and with Carmen, and I guess I would say like Silverwig, I guess it's a little more complex in this novel because we have these different layers and power dynamics in that female archetype.
Yeah, I'm kind of dying to know your thoughts on all of, like, the female character inserts, because I was kind of expecting there to be, like, the one female character, and with so many different types of women, I thought it was a really interesting choice.
Hard to keep track, yeah, because we came off of, when we read this, we had just finished reading The Maltese Falcon, which has a very straightforward femme fatale figure, and I would argue that both Vivian and Carmen are each like dangerous women and dangerous in their own ways. And so I think you could make an argument for either or both of them being the femme fatale here. I think part of that probably results from the fact that when writing this, Chandler was amalgamating multiple like short stories. And so Carmen and Vivian were each different figures in individual stories that then like came together into this one story.
So I think that's part.
So that's part of why it feels like there's like so much going on here. But Mona, I think, is kind of a different kind of noir archetype that we see in other stories as well, where she's more of the like pure, innocent woman, right? We get dangerous women, but we also get pure woman in need of saving or protecting in some way.
Right. Yeah.
And Mona clearly has like this idealized view of the world, and Marlowe's drawn to that and drawn to her purity and her ability to believe in the good of people, which he clearly lacks, right? He doesn't see good in anyone.
Right.
But I think that's part of why he's drawn to her, because he does see good in her, right? And she's maybe the only character that we see in the novel who could be considered good or less morally conflicted.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting to then look at Philip Marlowe as a character, you know, we're saying that these female archetypes are always in need of saving. And, mm-hmm. you know, that is sort of like a foundational thing that, like, this is a novel that does not stray from knight in shining armor versus damsel in distress. Like, it doesn't shy away from that, but it definitely complicates it in mm-hmm. the fact that, like, that knight motif is a little, you know, he's got to get his hands dirty, mm-hmm. As we see in his concluding monologue. But I wanted to talk about sort of like the general knight motif, you know, mm-hmm. when Philip Marlowe goes to General Sternwood's mansion, we see, you know, the knight on the Sternwood crest. Yeah, and then he's moving around the chess pieces. And I think there's such like a blatant line. I was like, why don't you just hit me over the head with it?
Yep.
And it was like, the knight doesn't have any purpose here. Yep. When he's like moving it at home. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he has another comment with like, there's a knight reference. And so I just wanted to talk about sort of like that context culturally. So we're coming out of World War I. Mm-hmm. Why is this our hero? Because like in the 40s, you know, we have superheroes. We have mm-hmm. Superman. You know, you get legitimate superheroes. But instead here we have these sort of morally gray, we have the morally gray hard-boiled detective. And I was just sort of interested in why you think that mm-hmm. is, why that, yeah. I guess.
So these, you know, veterans are coming back and feeling a sense of isolation, and I think we see that with Marlowe, right? He's isolated from society and those yeah. around him. He's an alcoholic.
Oh, yeah.
He is morally gray, but he, compared to the other characters, at least has this code of honor, right? Which, I don't know if you can say it makes him a better person than the other characters, mm-hmm. but he's trying to change things around him for the better, right? Yeah. And kind of rectify this like unrectifiable situation because the world is just dark now. So it's a futile quest, but he's still committed to the quest regardless.
Yeah. And I guess it makes sense, like World War I,
yep.
you go and fight, everyone dies. Everyone dies, you come back, and what was it all for?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and so it's sort of like good and bad, question mark.
Yes.
You know, people doing what they can. And it's also like, it's a discussion of this crime syndicate that he sort of embeds mm-hmm. himself in is a profession in and of itself. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, the law enforcement channel that we don't even see is a business, but it doesn't work for Philip Marlowe. And we hear that in this novel. You know, he was fired. He was fired because he spoke too much.
Didn't get along.
Yeah, they didn't get along. And so it's, he's sort of like fighting, he's fighting the man, but he's also like fighting the bad man. He's fighting like the crime man.
Exactly.
Like, he's doing what the institutions like can't be bothered to do. Yeah. Right.
I had a lot of thoughts about that. And like, is he punching up at people or like, people that he gets along with? He gets along with some of the cops. Mm-hmm. He also looks up to a lot of the criminals that are above him. So, like, what does that kind of, like, layering look like? Mm-hmm. And where does he fall in all of that? I'm curious your thoughts.
Like, there's some, like, good criminals and some bad cops.
Exactly.
And we have a spectrum of morality. Like, your profession does not equal your goodness or badness, right?
Yes.
In the noir world.
Yes.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, I also, not to bring it back to the superhero conversation, but Hannah and I were talking briefly about this, like where this fits into what you would look at the main character, Philip Marlowe, as today. And it was reminding me a lot of kind of like those superheroes and how they work with the cops, but they have to work outside of that. And we almost kind of don't see a whole lot of characters like this anymore. But even like the witty dialogue is reminding me a lot of like Spider-Man, like
that new Batman movie, the Robert Pattinson one.
Yeah,
that's a noir film.
Noir film,
absolutely. Like
literally noir
textbook
film.
Noir film.
Absolutely,
he is
yes.
the noir detective. So yeah.
God, that movie rocks. I'm sorry, that movie rocks.
Yeah.
Like, I will not hear somebody. There's another 3-hour movie that people told me was boring.
I think some editing.
It did need to be 3 hours.
But
like,
yeah. I think and part of why I liked it better than the average superhero movie was because of those noir elements, which made it different, fresh, and cool.
Yeah, but it's also, it sort of resembles, and we were talking about like what now can we even sort of draw even a little similarity to? Yeah. And it's like Knives Out? What's his name? Daniel Craig's
character.
Gosh, I wish I remembered that detective's name. He's sort of like that, which sort of likens him then to Agatha Christie sort of things. But again, this is a little dirtier, a little more rated R
definitely
than Knives Out, for sure. And especially this, I mean, and that's a big thing, which we've also discussed, like film adaptations had to cut out so much of this book because it's all about sort of a pornography ring. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it on the podcast. Arthur Gwynn Geiger sells porn. That is the narrative for us.
And I mean, they even cut out Reagan, a lot of his character in the book. The thing is that he's attached to Vivian, who's having an affair. And that's just kind of not in the movie. I mean, they had to make a lot of it. Even watching the movie, it wasn't exactly
they couldn't put it on the screen.
Right.
Carmen's not waiting for him fully unclothed in his apartment. Ready to seduce him.
I'm also dying to talk about Carmen.
Let's talk about women.
Women and agency. Yes. I need to know your thoughts. There's this scene in the end of the book that is completely cut out from the movie where Carmen tries to shoot Philip Marlowe, but her gun has been loaded with blanks. Great scene, I thought.
So good.
Was so excited to see it adapted. And then
the whole resolution of the plot completely changed
and
for the film.
In the book, it was her sense of agency was almost taken away, I want to say, because they reference her and they say, oh, well, when she did that, she was having an epileptic fit. Mm-hmm. And I was so curious about your thoughts as to why he's taking away that sort of agency in women.
Carmen is truly, I think, one of the weirdest characters in the history of literature. I'm gonna make that claim because I've never encountered another character like her. And I have conflicted feelings about her because on the one hand, I like how she doesn't adhere to any kind of standards of womanhood or femininity, those expectations of the time. There's a Kathleen Rowe has this concept of the unruly woman as a literary trope. Carmen is very much an unruly woman, I love my unruly woman. But also the infantilization.
Yeah. She's always sucking her thumb, being coy, I think her father says. Yes.
And those we talked about the animalistic qualities too. Yeah. It's almost grotesque the way he describes it.
Taking the wings off of flies.
Yeah. He's baring crawling, her teeth and growling.
On her hands and knees. What?
It's very odd characterization that I was personally not prepared for, but found very interesting.
Well, it's dated. I mean, that is a big thing, which huge disclaimer before you read this book, it is dated. The discussions of women and implications of homosexuality are supposed to be, it's othering. They don't want you to associate those things with goodness. They want you to associate them with criminality.
Yeah. Right.
So that is dated. We're not going to endorse that. But
sit around and pretend it's not.
But yeah, the unruly woman, especially with Carmen, is particularly provocative.
And I think we can make some efforts to reclaim these female characters from noir texts, even though they're written a particular way where we're supposed to think negatively of them. They're kind of cool. We can look back at them and appreciate these dangerous women who are breaking the moral codes, right? It's kind of empowering to read them now if you read them through a particular lens, right?
Sure.
I'm conflicted. We read this article by Megan Abbott in class as well, where she is a noir writer, a contemporary noir writer. You're aware of Megan Abbott?
Yes.
Okay. I love Megan Abbott. She basically has said, I just wanted to write myself into this world of Raymond Chandler.
Yeah.
Because she grew up.
Wow, I had no idea that she was connected to Raymond.
Yes, he's a big influence on
that
her.
Makes so much
sense. Yeah. It's very much, she's writing hard-boiled fiction now, but female-centered, which is really cool. Yeah. But she talks about how, she has a complicated relationship with Chandler. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard even viewing, it's hard reading it because I think from a certain perspective, right, you get tired of the only women in these books. I mean, and right? Like, reading like The Maltese Falcon, then The Big Sleep, then LA Confidential, but then it's also just in every single noir book and film adaptation, women are not, it's not central to them, and they are very much caricatures of these sort of like very Puritan fearing, you know, ideas of women, where like, right, like Carmen is an unruly woman and that she is constantly naked. All she wants to do is have sex, and she, you know, what's the word? She like definitely lets it be known she wants to have sex with Marlo on multiple occasions.
And she has great legs.
Yes. She has great
Chandler
legs.
Chandler loves the legs.
He does love
He cannot describe a woman without discussing her legs.
Well, you got to think about it. How many legs were they seeing back then? So when he was seeing it, he was like, I want to die. And then he did. But he wrote about it. Anyway.
I guess, like, I'm also so wanting to talk about the kind of monologue at the end.
Yes.
Like, give me your... Explain a little bit about what the audience should be thinking during this monologue.
I'm wondering if we should just, like, read it, just that one paragraph or part of it, to get an idea.
Yeah. So,
what did it matter where you lay once you were dead? In a dirty sump or in a marble tower on top of a high hill? You were dead. You were sleeping the big sleep. It's the title of the novel.
Reference.
You were not bothered by things like that. Oil and water were the same as wind and air to you. You just slept the big sleep, not caring about the nastiness of how you died or where you fell. Me, I was part of the nastiness now.
Wow.
Such a classic line.
Yeah, I found that. I was like, yeah.
Yes. So Chandler's background, he didn't start out with novels. He was a poet initially. And I think you feel that reading through, right? Especially comparing it to The Maltese Falcon. Like, not saying anything bad about Hammett and his writing style, but
it's not as
striking or literary, right? Yeah. But here you get those, like, really, that evocative language that's just so impactful.
Yeah.
And especially at the end of the novel, like, the way he brings it all together there. And I think that him being part of the nastiness now, my first thought is, like, was he not before?
Yeah.
Right? Like, it seems like he's been embroiled in this nastiness, but he's also bringing us into the nastiness, kind of, right? He's, like, implicating us by sharing the story with us and us reading the story. We are implicated as well, so.
Absolutely agree. I mean, he definitely has some, like, cognitive dissonance going on where he's like, no, like, I'm actually perfect, like, throughout a lot of this. And then once he goes through this entire journey, that's when he's kind of accepted where he's at.
Right.
Yeah.
Accepting that he is not this upstanding knight
figure.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a lot of the language, like you pointed out, I didn't know that he had done any poetry, but I underlined some lines where I was like, wow. Just like comparisons, even dialogue is really, really great. I have one line that I underlined where he said, "Their accounts of the affair came as close to the truth as newspaper stories usually come, as close to Mars is to Saturn."
Yeah.
And I just thought that was hilarious. It reminds me of that quote where it's like, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bicycle, which I think is great.
No, he's got some great stuff. And even like the short dialogue feels, I mean, no one, like, we've also discussed this, like, there's no one talking like that, really, right?
It's exaggerated. Right.
It's exaggerated, but it's so good.
Yeah.
And like, now, and like, if you ask somebody, if you went outside and you were like, how did people talk in the 1930s? They would be like, wow, what's up, what's up? You know, they would do this.
The caricature of it.
Yeah, yeah, they would do this, which I think is also just very interesting as just, like, again, like, with the cultural connotations of that, but also just how much violence there is. How much violence there is. Like, we're supposed to, like, there's one line where, so essentially when Carmen is being blackmailed for these pornographic pictures, we don't know where they are, and then this guy Brody has them for a period of time. And with Brody, Marlo sort of interrogates him in his way, and then is like, oh, you know, it's just a few murders, that's small change in your field. And they're like, and then they just like sort of laugh it off. But it like is. By the end, we have compiling list of corpses, yep. you know? So I also just wanted to know why, like, that's also just sort of striking to me within the time period, I guess. And how, like, this is the trailblazer, right? Like, the things that follow it came out, like, definitely took inspiration from this.
Yeah.
So was it, like, do we really think it was that bad? Like, was it?
And I think even with how violent it is, like, now it might seem a little tame, maybe, since we're inundated with, like, police procedurals, Law and Order, like, the John Mulaney bit, right?
Yeah.
You can say anything on TV now.
Yeah.
But I think part of that, it was scandalous at the time and tantalizing, yeah. right? And I think that's part of why it took a while for noir to be seen as, like, serious literature.
Yeah.
Because it was kind of, like, more, like, low culture, right?
Yeah.
Partially because of this, the violence and the pornography and all this dirtiness, right?
Yeah.
And that's, Chandler also got his start, we talked a little bit about, in Black Mask, which was a pulp magazine, which pulp magazines are, like, the definition of low culture, right?
Yeah.
They're not literary at all, but this is literary, so I appreciate that there's been efforts to, like, reclaim that and view them, and I feel like I'm trying to do that work partially with, like, the class and teaching The Big Sleep and The Maltese Falcon and treating them as, you know, important literary objects, literary texts.
Because they are.
As absolutely.
As we just said, if you go outside and you ask someone to do an impression of someone from the 1940s, they're going to give you, like, Humphrey Bogart, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Who is Philip Marlowe, like, 100%.
And I do think that's that, like, cultural connotation that we have now is more cemented because of the adaptations than it is because of the literary source material.
Oh,
right?
Because
people think noir, they think the movies, Hollywood, not so much Raymond, to an extent Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, right? But not as much as Humphrey Bogart embodying
definitely.
Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, and it's sad to think that they were such low, like, that it was regarded as, like, low culture, as, like, right, like a pulp thing.
Right.
Because, like, do you know Carol? Like, the book, well, what's it called? The Price of Salt.
Mm.
The Price of Salt was also technically a pulp book.
Right.
Like, it was printed with, like, a noir cover, and it's, like, it's Carol. Like, if you've seen the 2015 movie Carol,
so good.
It's not a noir, you know? Like, big surprise. But, like, it has to do with gay people, so they were like, this is a homosexual romance novel, we don't want, like, this isn't for, right, this isn't, like, high culture, this isn't for society.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
It has to be a different category.
Yeah. Right.
It's for the French to really appreciate detective fiction, American detective fiction.
And I mean, like, French. Actually, don't shout out the French.
Yeah, let's not. Let's take that back.
Okay. Anyway, I don't
French
know if I want to do that. Yeah.
It'd be great art, you know?
Yeah.
You went off with Monet.
Croissants.
Yeah. With croissants. Yes, Sam. Yes, they did.
So, thinking about that and just, like, the idea of class in this book, there is so much to talk about with that. I mean, we've talked about a little bit with the idea of where he falls and looking up to some criminals and looking down upon some cops, but, like, where does he fall in the situation of class? Because he's getting some money, but it's stated a bunch of times he's really not making a ton of money off of this. So, like, why is he doing it? Is he going up in his class, or, like, what is the goal? Where does he stand with that?
I mean, noir, particularly hard-boiled detective fiction, is a genre that to an extent ignores social dynamics like class and race.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of the discussion of that is implicit more than explicit, right? Like, we can look for mentions of class and kind of read certain characters as belonging to certain classes. Obviously, the Sternwoods are, like, the embodiment of the upper class.
They got money.
Yeah.
But they're decaying in their own right. They don't have as much money as they used to. They all say that they live frivolous lives. I mean, even the general admits to being sort of like a failure when it comes to that, and he just sort of gives them money all.
Vivian's spending all of her inheritance on gambling.
Yeah, at Eddie Marr's, his club.
And I mean, General Sternwood.
What a name.
Love that name, first of all. But General Sternwood is, like, physically decaying, essentially. And is that not supposed to be completely representative of what's kind of happening to their family and their money and how it's just going down the drain? Even with Vivian betting all of it on Red, like, you know, being frivolous with all of that. And it's physically embodied in their dad.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that description of General Sternwood is so grotesque.
I know. He's like, he is. He's like mold. He's like moldy.
And he's completely aware of it, too.
He's
the,
like,
crazy part. He's like, I am sitting here and I'm physically dying in front
of
you.
He's like, I'm a vegetable. Yeah.
And
look
I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I need to be in the sauna.
Doesn't he describe his hair as like flowers clinging to an old rock or something?
Oh, it's like something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my God.
A crazy opening.
You see him in the movie and he's just like an old man.
I know. I was like,
it's like a quilt on his lap. And you're like, oh, okay.
The class isn't apparent in like a novel overall. I don't think it's classless. I think it's just high class.
Right. Yeah.
Because like if it's low class, it would like... There's no such thing as class.
Right. Class and to respond, I was going to bring us back to the final passage of the novel. Because the part we didn't read was, I was part of the nastiness now, far more a part of it than Rusty Reagan was, but the old man didn't have to be. He could lie quiet in his canopied bed with his bloodless hands folded on the sheet, waiting. Right, so he is the driving factor for basically all the events of the novel, right? He's the one who brings Marlowe into the nastiness.
I mean, absolutely the inciting incident.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to witness the fallout of all of that, right? Or experience that. He gets to lie in his ivory tower and just die.
And it seems like, I don't know, he could lie quiet in his canopied bed. You know, he could with his bloodless hands. It seems like he resents the fact that, like, General Sternwood is... you know, has this ability to do it. Yeah. But he also sees it as his duty. I mean, he's right this, like, he is the protector between these two barriers of life, right?
It's not just his duty, it's his burden, right? Like,
wow.
And he's envious of Rusty Reagan and General Sternwood for getting to just kind of fade into the big sleep. He has to keep on taking care of the city, right? He's the one who has to keep it all together.
I mean, into the big sleeve bars. I'm sorry, that was like a
that
line.
Was an awesome line.
That's the chess piece. Chess piece tattoo.
I mean, death is such a complicated thing.
Yes.
In this book, it's a thank you, snaps for Sam. Like,
death is so complicated.
It is. Yes. It is. I mean, it's a privilege for some people and a punishment for others. Because
Mic drop.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, General Sternwood, like, does that guy want to be alive? Probably not.
Living is a burden for him.
Exactly.
Just breathing is painful.
Exactly. I mean, but for others, who is it? Harry Jones?
Harry Kane?
Harry Jones.
Gotta be Harry Jones. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, we'll check right now.
Yeah, Harry Jones.
Harry Jones.
Yeah. I mean, for him, it's sort of a tragic death. Like, he died going out, you know, trying to protect this person that he thought he truly loved.
And Agnes.
Agnes, who ends up not even really being devastated at all. So I guess it depends on the class a little bit.
Harry Jones is femme fatale.
Yeah.
But death is kind of just complicated depending on, like, what class you're in and what your job is in this entire network of crime and everything.
Yeah.
And that Harry Jones sequence is so interesting. Did you guys also get... I was trying to see... Because this... I didn't get it the first time I read through. But this time I was like, does he know, like, that he's... It seemed like there was an implication that he... was willingly drinking, like, he knew something was up with the drink. And he was just saving Agnes.
Especially in the film.
Yes.
Especially in the film, you can tell that he knows that's gonna be the end.
That he's being poisoned by, what's his name?
Lash Canino.
Can we just, like, I also would just love to talk about these names for a sec. Because we did it in class, and oh my gosh, they're so nickname-y. I mean,
Mona Mars.
Mona Mars. Philip. Yeah, right. Like, Eddie Mars,
Doghouse Riley.
Doghouse Riley, but the Sternwoods, Vivian.
Yeah.
I love the name Vivian. But like Vivian and Carmen. And
Puss Walgreen is my favorite one.
Who?
Puss Walgreen.
Unbelievable names. Lash Canino is like...
I'm obsessed. Yes. I'm truly obsessed.
When I read Eddie Mars the first time, I was like, yeah. I do
is
like
Is this
that
not
name.
A jazz singer?
I like, do like that name.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's good because then you remember them, and when you're reading and there are 18 other people being thrown at you.
They're distinctive. Yeah. And they also embody like elements of their character, like their profession, right? Just to build off of the death comment too, something I wanted to mention was that Chandler kind of idealizing death in this final passage of the novel. You read it differently knowing that he himself was an alcoholic and depressed and...
A poet.
Yes, and a poet and attempted suicide. So Chandler himself, I think, definitely has conflicted feelings about death in that you feel that throughout the novel, right? And that's how you... Why... It's written as kind of a release, right, for several characters.
Yeah. He's saying, like, Carmen and Vivian, like, get off.
Oh, totally.
Scot-free.
Yeah.
So, like, there's no death there, which, like, sometimes there is in noir stuff. Right, like,
Fatale has to be punished for her actions.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
if you have sex, you die, right? Like, or if you have an affair, especially, I mean...
God forbid.
Which, like, they cut out Rusty Reagan as a character in the film because the production code... that, you know, sort of was across all of, what was it, Warner Brothers, MGM, the big studio system. They had this production code, which you couldn't cheat on your spouse. Yeah. You couldn't show murder. You know,
Carmen
so
can't
many
be naked.
Things. Carmen cannot be naked.
The irony of applying rules of morality to these films that are adaptations of novels that are about how morality is like out the window, right? So like noir doesn't have those rules that are imposed upon it, like the production code, but then when you translate them into films, like you were talking about earlier, so much has to be taken out because there are these rules.
And I think that's why this was such an interesting choice to be able to read and watch kind of back to back and see what it was that they could and couldn't do at the time.
Out of each of the novel and the film is completely different.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
It's still interesting that, and I wanted to talk about this, I mentioned it earlier, about the, like, homosexuality that's present. Mm. I actually brought it up to Sam, and I was like, did you catch the gay
thing? I was like, no.
And Sam was like, no. Dylan caught it.
Shout out. I was behind.
Yeah, no, but I this literally the second I opened the page and they started describing his home, Geiger's home. It's super, you know, exotic, you know.
They make
there's so much orientalism in there. The way that
two forms of otherness together,
And so it's just like they're just piling all of this cultural, like contextual hints about, you know, the way that people who are othered of the time were viewed by society. So it's like him being very, having all of this wealth and spending it on these expensive fabrics that you see draped all over his place and they're drugs and whatnot. And it's like, oh, and he's gay. And you're just supposed to get that from this description, even though no one has said anything about that. And he even has like his like, it's suggested that his lover is
Carol Lundgren,
who is then killed immediately too.
Right. I mean, I didn't get it at first, which this is my first noir book that I've read, so you know, I'm giving myself a break. Yeah. But watching the film after Hannah said, like, by the way, that guy's gay, I watched the film, and when they're taking the camera out of this ornate, beautiful lamp in like the shape of like
so
a bus, I was like, okay.
I see
it. Okay.
Yeah.
The film sanitizes that a little bit because in the novel, Lundgren kind of ritualistically poses Geiger in his bed as like a sign of affection for him, which is one of the hints that like they are together. They have a romantic relationship. That whole element of like moving the body is not in the film, right? Because it wouldn't make sense if they don't want to imply that.
Yeah.
It's just another layer of danger and criminality that we're supposed to attach to, which I thought is just like so interesting because that is a noir thing as well. I mean, in The Maltese Falcon, Joel Cairo as a character is also, he's supposed to be gay.
Right.
Queer-coded. Yeah, definitely. But like, this is just like, he's the ringleader of this pornography, you know, enterprise.
Right.
And it's just very interesting how it's almost what 100 years.
Yeah.
We're coming up on like 90 years, you know,
That's crazy.
And like, I don't know.
No,
if
someone
tried to associate homosexuality with like danger now, like that would just be like so wrong.
Right.
And also it's just like no one would even think to do that because it's so not culturally significant.
Yeah.
But back then, I mean,
And it's kind of like,
she'd see the heebie-jeebies.
That social context that we were talking about earlier, where Chandler like kind of wants to incorporate that, but he doesn't really want to like address it or discuss it meaningfully, right?
Definitely.
And I mean, we see that in the fact that this is definitely like a white male noir world.
Right.
This is Raymond Chandler's world. We don't see race, right? We don't really see these super apparent distinctions of class.
Mm-hmm.
They're more suggested at. Yeah. But like, that's not true. Like, right? Which, like, something like a neo-noir like L.A. Confidential is going to rewrite and do it very aggressively.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And tell you that...
Explicit.
Oh yeah, and say there are black people and Hispanic people living in LA, and that's
and
who's taking
people.
The fall. Yeah, and gay people who are taking the fall for these crimes. They are the fall guys.
Yeah.
We don't just get to pick some, you know, random henchmen.
Yeah, and absolutely, class is also much more explicit.
Oh yeah,
of a theme in LA Confidential as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so with the film adaptation, I was just sort of interested in how you view, you know, how you see this noir as special relative to the genre. I really wanted to see how you thought about that. And then we can talk more about, like, the film adaptation, too, in that sense. But, yeah, like, what sets this, like, why this one?
And I wish I've read more Chandler so I could compare it to his other novels. But I think Chandler stands out because of his writing style. Like, I think that's why he's endured culturally and, like, continues to be listed on, you know, class syllabi and such. Because it's evocative and it's impactful and it sticks with you. I first encountered this text in an undergraduate noir class. Which now... almost a decade ago now.
Now you're teaching one.
Look at how the turntables.
But I hadn't read it since then, but I was like, I remember that scene of Carmen trying to kill Marlowe, the scene in Geiger's apartment. Like, I just, the feeling of like reading those the first time, it stayed with me all those years. I think that's why it stands out amongst the genre.
Definitely. Yeah.
I mean, it's iconic. And also, like you were talking about, there's so many different characters with archetypes that you might not come across in, like, combined and see interacting in every type of noir or even just, like, other types of books. You just don't see these kind of characters. Like, you were saying that Carmen is one of your, like... just a very... I don't even want to say favorite. Because she's written in a way... that is not, like, super flattering towards women at the time. I mean, even watching the film, she's a fully grown adult.
Right.
Like, I was almost expecting to see her look younger on screen, but I was like, no, they're just writing her. They're just infantilizing her quite a bit.
Yeah, rough goings.
Yeah.
Rough goings. But they cut out most of her scenes anyway so that they could get Vivian in more, just so Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall could, like, make out. which, like... no complaints, but
what the audience is wanting.
It's the people what they want.
Definitely what we wanted. They saw To Have and To Have Not, and they were like, honestly,
more
of that. We don't care about the other stuff. In the film stuff, like as we just said, like Carmen cut down so much. Female characters cut down so much. Because there can only be one.
Mona, too.
Mona.
That's such a tragic cut.
Because she's...
we see her so briefly.
only in the end.
Yeah.
Only in the end.
How many lines does she have? Like,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But it's,
yeah.
But I do think that in the adaptation, the one thing that does, that is very core to the noir genre, especially in literature, and sort of this vulgarity, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You do, I think that the film does keep the style of his language true.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that, the dialogue is, and just the way that it looks, mm-hmm. it feels the same way.
Yeah.
And, you know, those missing pieces, you fill in it for yourself if you've read the book. You know that they're there and that it is the subtext to a certain point. But I do think that you're saying, like, what makes Chandler, what makes this book so iconic and what makes him such an iconic writer is that dialogue and how stylistic it is.
Yeah.
It's blunt, but it's quick-witted. And so it's funny while it's also, like, beautifully tragic at other points, and it's like, yeah, that is how you feel at the end of the movie.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Wow. I do love that you get that dialogue component, and I do love the movie, but I love it for different reasons, and I think I love the novel because I think the one thing that is missing that makes the book special is that interiority that we get of Marlowe. Like, we are truly inside his mind, and we get to see the way that he sees the world.
Definitely.
And he's such an introspective character, and I think that's why people are drawn to him.
Yeah.
And he does feel the sense of isolation, which, you know, you can relate to if you feel that way as well.
I know, like, what would happen if they gave this book to us in 10th grade instead of Catcher in the Rye?
Wow. People
what? To Hamlet.
Yeah, right.
Teenage.
Yeah. You're like, oh, no.
Oh.
Smoking
the pipe.
Calling people toots.
Yeah. You just die.
I feel like there are TikTokers who, like, I've come upon who, like, want to be
this
who
so
like
bad.
13-year-old.
I wore a fedora when I was 14. So
yes,
I'm guilty
like,
of
speak on it.
Yeah.
No, a crooner,
oh
our
God.
20th century crooner. But yeah, it's so great. And so, like, let's just for funsies, who's everyone's favorite character in the book versus the movie?
The movie. I like. Is it crazy if I do say Carmen?
No.
It has to be Carmen.
Okay, Carmen.
She's very unique.
Yes.
Yeah.
In
like,
both the book and the movie, or
not
book
the
Carmen?
Movie.
Not the movie. I would say in the movie, I'm gonna say Harry.
Harry.
Yeah,
he's
I like
pie.
Him. He's a cutie.
Yeah. How about you?
I was just looking at my list trying to decide. The book. That's hard. I would say probably Vivian.
Yeah. We're asking the hard-hitting questions.
In the movie, I have a better movie answer, the bookshop girl.
Yes! Yes! Wait,
that's one of my favorite scenes.
Closing the blinds.
Yeah.
And then immediate cut to.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, the movie didn't want to have her, Vivian, being married and potentially having an affair.
Right.
But they did want to throw in a random sex scene that, like...
They wanted to make Marlowe this Lothario who's, like, women are throwing themselves.
Like, why not? Low-key, it's a good scene.
Yeah, yeah,
like, why did they go off? Why did they put all of their eggs in that basket?
Like,
I don't get it.
The writers were sitting there. They were like, wait. What if we... No.
What if we closed the blinds and suggested that they had sex a la Casablanca?
And they got it in.
Necessary.
Yeah. They got it in. So
yeah.
I can't hate.
So that's the movie?
Yes, I would say the bookshop girl for sure for the movie.
Okay.
And then I'll do Vivian and Carmen for the book.
Okay. And Carmen.
Iconic. And Hannah, yours.
I'm so boring. I was going to be like Marlowe. I was going to be like Marlowe is my favorite character in the book. I just think, I do find the book sort of like, I smirk throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I have a cheeky little smirk on my face while I'm reading the whole thing.
Yeah.
And not to say that I don't love Humphrey Bogart. Like, don't get it twisted. But I do think that my favorite part of the film is probably Vivian.
Yeah.
I love... Lauren Bacall is just sort of... like the quintessential femme fatale in my head.
Yeah. Which is why it's so weird that she's like not really in the movie.
I mean, I was watching it, I was waiting.
Good.
Yeah.
It's like she didn't cover up her husband's death. Boo, boring.
Yeah, the bad thing she does in the novel or like sanitize and then he's like, I can fix you at the end.
Yeah, I know. But I just like I like looking at her. You're amazing. Her voice.
Yeah.
Obsessed.
But I also wanted to say, like, you were talking about at the beginning that one of the most important parts of a book like this is just, like, being immersed in the world and having that, like, that vibe to carry you through. And I think the reason that I liked the movie is that it somehow captured that vibe and carried it through. Even if it got rid of many of my favorite scenes. Right. Like, I think it's important to remember that, like, the overarching texture of it.
And that's, like, it's harder to capture in a novel, right? Versus visually, you get that on film. So I think that's why our perception of, like, our cultural memory surrounding noir is so much of that, like, imagery that we get from film noir.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
But the world building it's so good in both the book and the film. And I think that's part of why I love noir. I mean, I love detective stuff in general. I always have. Yeah. It's a big Nancy Drew child.
Yes.
I had the whole collection.
The Hardy Boys.
I was about Nancy Drew. And also, there were so many, like, spunky girl detectives. I loved that.
Oh,
like,
my God. Harriet the Spy.
Yeah, Harriet the Spy.
Cam Jansen. Cam Jansen, of course.
I loved Cam Jansen so much. I've never met another soul who loves Cam Jansen or knows what that is.
It's like emotional to watch. You two connect.
Where are the Cam Jansen fans at?
I know.
Turn up.
Oh my gosh.
I'll put you on it, trust.
Okay. I'll look forward to it.
But, like, so much of my love for noir does come from that. Just, like, general love for detective stuff. But also, I feel like I love noir in the same way that someone who loves fantasy loves that, and that I just love getting sucked into this, like, fantastical, exaggerated, like, unreal world of 1940s Los Angeles, which is, like, not actually, like, a photorealistic 1940s Los Angeles.
No,
it's, like, a cultural imaginary of it. Yeah, but, like, that's the 1940s Los Angeles I want to go to, even though there's dead bodies piling up and gambling, and still,
everything
I want to go
so
there.
Bad.
Yeah.
So, but it's so hot.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I still want to be in the Hunger Games, even though I would definitely die immediately.
Yeah. No, but I just thought, to wrap us up, we're talking about immersing ourselves in worlds when we're reading. And I find that the place that we do that is in a library. Mm. So I have a question to ask.
Incredible transition, thank you.
CMU, what is the spot? Mm. Hunt Library or Sorel's?
I've never even been to Sorel's. I mean, Hunt is the, like, humanities library, right? So any book that I've needed in the past 4 years, I've been able to get there if they have it. They're a little lacking in the book department and the libraries here, but
So Hunt?
Yes. Yeah. Probably I would vote for Hunt, but really neither.
Yeah, no, that's so fair. Yeah. They suck.
I appreciate the Carnegie library system, public library system, way more than the CMU.
Yeah, very beautiful.
Yes. Absolutely.
And you?
I'm gonna have to go Hunt, fourth floor. You're technically not allowed to eat up there, but, like, sometimes I sneak in a granola bar.
You just put that on blast. Put that on blast. They're coming after you. I hear them. The sirens are wailing.
Yeah, exactly. And Hannah, I know it's going to be...
What?
Okay, no, just say it.
It's Sorel's. I love Sorel's. There are no windows, but I love being in there. They have some comfy... They have comfy seats, which Hunt, I fear, does not provide me if I go upstairs.
I have
anywhere.
Taken a nap in the Sorel's beanbags.
Yes.
See, I think that's part of the problem is I try to avoid spending time in the libraries as much. Like, I have my other spaces where I like to do work and hang
and
out.
Books.
I have an office, which is nice, not to brag, but, like, I find myself spending most of my time there.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Because I like the isolation.
For sure, Z's.
Love.
All right. Well, if you want to be a guest on the podcast, follow our Instagram at CMU Booked. And, you know, you can DM us, reach out to any of us, yell at Sam, tackle me and Ween, as we said. And next week, we don't have an episode coming out because, as I previously said, spring break.
Ooh, ooh.
Go spring breakers.
We need a break.
Yeah, we do need a break.
Oh, we do.
But we'll be back the week following with No Country for Old Men. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys in 2 weeks.
We love you all.
Bye.
Bye.
Mwah.